The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So Karl Marx sketched the economic, organizational, and political stages through which the working class strives for its self-emancipation. Capitalist development creates a working class in conditions of exploitation, which workers first resist individually, then collectively through strikes, shop by shop, then industry-wide, locally, then nationally. Through a few victories and many defeats, all ultimately flowing toward a common identification with our whole class. We also go from purely industrial to political action. And in that political action, from subordinate alliance with the capitalists, like against the landlords and kings and things, to political independence from the bourgeoisie. And from there, toward the conscious capacity to lead all the oppressed in social revolution. Meanwhile, capitalist growth, crisis, and restructuring continually both undermine and seed our progress. The working class in the United States, as well as globally, peaked in its consciousness, politics, and organization in the first half of the 20th century, while sliding jaggedly backwards in the second half. I believe that the industrial workers of the world and the revolutionary syndicalist current they were part of internationally vitally bridged and advanced our class's progress toward those mid-century high points. In changed conditions, Marxists today aim to bring our class back to those previously reached high levels in the all-sided process of self-emancipation, despite changed conditions. Some specific issues confronted by the IWW and other syndicalists remain today, and in these areas we can extract lessons. But we can also gain by understanding the dynamics of the overarching historical process of working class development, and how revolutionary organizations consciously participated in this process. When Marx wrote the manifesto, the only nationwide working class movement so far existed in England. In 1848, the workers of Paris made our class's first bid for power, drowned in blood in the June days. In 1871, in the Paris Commune, an entire city fell into the workers' hands for the first time for several weeks. So the working class movement's origins are explosive. And building on those origins, in the last three decades of the 19th century, workers' power took on durable mass forms. The socialist and labor parties that grew to millions of members and more voters, and the union federations that were often controlled by them. Marxist influence grew first through the International Working Men's Association, which lasted from 1864 to 1872, then through the much larger Second International, founded in 1889. And with mass organization, unavoidable pressures to incorporate into the system came. In the US, the overthrow of the Southern slave power tilted Reconstruction-era politics in the U.S. briefly toward real democracy. The first nationwide union federation, the National Labor Union, was formed in 1866. The Depression of 1873 led to the first spontaneous national strike, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. The first coordinated national strike, the 8-hour day strike of 1886, coincided with the first mass union movement, some say in the world, that was led by revolutionaries, the International Working People's Association in Chicago, led by anarchists and Marxists. Anarchist Albert Parsons and Marxist August Spies, leaders of this group, are considered by some to be the founders of syndicalism, which I'll come back to in a bit. They considered their union grouping, the Chicago Central Labor Union, to be itself a revolutionary body. And they developed what's been called the Chicago idea, which is that the unions themselves, built by and embracing the mass of working people, would themselves become the political and industrial administrators of society after they overthrew capitalism and revolution. The AFL, the U.S.'s first long-lasting nationwide union federation, also has its roots in the 1880s. The 1890s were a turning point. The economic crisis of 1893 set off the March on Washington by the poor masses in Coxey's army. The Pullman Railroad strike of 1895, led by future socialist Eugene Debs, and above all, the formation of the Populist Movement and the People's Party. Led mostly by desperate farmers in the South and Midwest, the Populist Movement also attracted the support of urban workers. And it was the first national challenge to the political leadership of the working class by the capitalists through their two-party system. And tragically, the Democrats succeeded in securing People's Party endorsement for their presidential candidate, William Jennings Bryan, in 1896, and that caused the People's Party to dissolve. But it had already proven the possibility of a mass political party outside the control of the capitalists, and thus it laid the basis for the formation of the Socialist Party in 1900. And by 1912, the Socialist Party, led by veterans of the People's Party, but more concentrated specifically on the working class, had 150,000 dues-paying members, dozens of daily newspapers. It got 6% of the vote in a four-way presidential race and had mayors and city councilors in dozens of towns. All of this is the backdrop to syndicalism. So what is syndicalism? Are there any syndicalists here? Okay, great. Thank you for raising your hand. Would you be interested in giving a brief, one sentence or less, definition?
Worker democracy.
Worker democracy. Okay, great. Yeah, I think that's correct. Syndicalism, the word sounds so exotic. Syndicate or sindicato in Spanish, it's a word for union. So a syndicalist, I think it'd be fair to say, is a unionist. But historically, it meant revolutionary unionism. So I think that incorporates worker democracy. We'll just say revolutionary unionism might be a good definition to start with. It's two words. Lenin famously said, quote, "In Western Europe, revolutionary syndicalism in many countries was a direct and inevitable result of opportunism, reformism, and parliamentary cretinism." In other words, the mass working class socialist parties like the German SPD and the French Socialist Party, built in the last decades of the 19th century, began betraying their working class supporters by favoring elections over strikes and then failing to fight once they even won electoral office. So the new syndicalist unions, built in the pre-World War I years, rejected elections and political parties altogether. They believed direct workplace action was a sufficient tactic, and unionism, provided it was revolutionary unionism, provided a sufficient organization to make a revolution. So for them, no parties, and for some syndicalists, just no politics were needed. Syndicalists organized a wing of the union movement internationally during the first decade of the new century. The French Syndicalist Union, the CGT, reached a membership of 400,000 during these years. And Belgian socialist Emile van der Velde, who was a top official of the Second International, he lamented that the CGT, through direct action tactics, had accomplished far more in concrete gains than the far larger German workers, which were affiliate unions affiliated to the Second International. He considered them just way more effective, and he was not a partisan. He was unhappy about that. The CGT emerged from attempts by different factions of the French Socialist Party to control them, to declare their fierce independence from all political parties. The CGT held the Chicago idea as their vision of revolution, and several but not all of the top leaders were anarchists. French syndicalism's success inspired similar sizable union movements in Italy, Spain, and Ireland. In the US, the IWW reacted primarily to the shortcomings not of the fledgling Socialist Party, but of the AFL. They criticized the AFL for its non-socialist, non-revolutionary reluctance to rely on strikes and direct action in the workplace, as well as for their racist opposition to Chinese and Mexican immigration and therefore immigrant workers, for their racist acceptance of the segregation of black members and their contempt for women and girls. But above all, in a decade in which the old line skilled worker-based unions suffered catastrophic setbacks in, for example, steel and meatpacking, as those industries mechanized production and became concentrated in giant monopoly firms. The Wobblies, that's what IWW organizers were called, Wobblies, they expressed frustration at the AFL's failure, with a few exceptions, to organize on a modern industrial instead of an old-fashioned craft basis. So, for example, the meatpacking plants here in Chicago had 12 AFL unions in them, like the butchers and other small crafts. 12 different divided unions. And those 12 between them organized only a small number of workers in the meatpacking plants. So the IWW joke was that the American Federation of Labor was really the American Separation of Labor. The IWW was founded in 1905 at a convention that its leader, Big Bill Haywood, called the Continental Congress of the Working Class. To give you a flavor of the politics of it, he said in his convention speech, "We're here to confederate the workers of this country into a working class movement that shall have for its purpose the emancipation of the working class from the slave bondage of capitalism. The aims and objectives of this organization should be to put the working class in possession of the economic power, the means of life, in control of the machinery of production and distribution without regard to capitalist masters. This organization will be formed, based, and founded on class struggle, having in view no compromise and no surrender." Socialist Party worker leaders Eugene Debs and Mother Jones, the entire Socialist Labor Party under Daniel De Leon, anarchist Lucy Parsons, a few local unions, and the whole Western Federation of Miners gave the IWW a small but promising start with about 23,000 members. Haywood and Debs were also simultaneously leaders in the Socialist Party. But over the years, the IWW became increasingly anti-political. Debs, for example, let his membership in the IWW lapse. The entire Socialist Labor Party left the IWW in 1908 to form their own separate IWW. It wasn't the first time that they'd done that. In the 1890s, Daniel De Leon's group left the Knights of Labor, and they left the AFL to form their own revolutionary dual union, the Socialist Trades and Labor Alliance, which was an utter failure. So, in the IWW, which espoused the Chicago idea, it appeared unnecessary to most members to deal with the Socialist Party that focused narrowly on elections. And especially when that party contained not only revolutionaries like Haywood and Debs, but also reformist white supremacists like Wisconsin Congressman Victor Berger. In 1905, the IWW Constitution's preamble stated, quote, "Between the two classes, a struggle must go on until all the toilers come together on the political as well as the economic fields." But in 1908, they voted to get rid of that political clause. The Socialist Party would organize important solidarity campaigns for IWW strikes. And the large Debs wing of the Socialist Party often supported the IWW over the AFL. But in 1912, the right wing on the Socialist Party National Executive Committee kicked Haywood off of that committee. And it was because he advocated sabotage, which was popular, you know, a form of direct action, and that was the language of the French syndicalists. So he was kicked off the National Executive by the Socialist Party right wing. The IWW not only participated in the historical process of our class's development towards self-emancipation, they did so consciously. One aspect of the self-emancipation concept is that working people should rely on ourselves, our own numbers, our own power, and our own collective action. And perhaps the IWW and syndicalism's greatest contribution was to demonstrate that. In 1906, the IWW invented the sit-down strike when GE workers in Schenectady, Pennsylvania sat in to protest the firing of an organizer. That strike lost, but 20 years later, a wave of 400 sit-downs, including at the world's biggest corporation, General Motors, marked the biggest breakthrough the U.S. unions and working class have achieved yet. Among the leaders of those sit-downs were former Wobblies. And you might even argue that the concept of Occupy comes from this same original source or strike. In 1912, 23,000 textile workers, many of them women and girls, went on strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and they called in the IWW to organize them. And the IWW emphasized mass action, democracy, and internationalism to triumphantly creative effect. They set up these thousand-strong picket lines around the plants. That was how they kept the scabs out of the plants. There were daily mass meetings and rallies, which featured simultaneous translation into multiple languages. There was a large elected strike committee, 56 workers, and the members intentionally represented 14 different language groups. And this provided a broad democratic leadership. Commenting on the strike, the great IWW agitator Elizabeth Gurley Flynn said, "The IWW is accused of putting women in the front. In reality, the IWW does not keep them in the back, and they come to the front." And the IWW built the strike as a broad class struggle, not just a struggle of the workers on the strike. So they cooperated with the Socialist Party so that New York strike sympathizers volunteered to take in the children of the starving workers during the strike. And when the police attacked those children, very publicly boarding the train to New York, the public outrage made a big contribution to the eventually victorious settlement of that strike. The Wobblies actively educated their members in anti-racism, and they stuck to those principles in the most extreme environments. In 1911 and 12, thousands of lumber workers in Louisiana, Arkansas, and Texas unionized independently. And the presence of black and white workers in about equal numbers in one union was a big step against racism and toward united working class power. But when Big Bill came to the lumber workers' convention in Louisiana, he was invited because they wanted to join the IWW. He found himself in front of a hall of all white workers, and he asked why. And they'd explained that we don't have any choice, it's against the law for black and white workers to be in the same hall. So he stood before the hall and said, "You work in the same mills together. Sometimes a black man and a white man chop down the same tree together. You're meeting in convention to discuss the conditions under which you labor. This cannot be done intelligently by passing resolutions here and then sending them to another room for the black men to vote on. Why not be sensible about this and call the Negroes into the convention? If it's against the law, this is one time where the law should be broken." And they enthusiastically did that. The lumber workers were broken by intense state and company violence. But they gave a heroic example of the potential for black-white unity that stood at the center of the 1930s mass industrial unionization successes. The IWW's class struggle approach meant that many of its strikes, its free speech campaigns, and its defense campaigns took on the dimensions of local uprisings. And they showed that an organization of thousands of worker activist revolutionaries with mass leadership ability could be assembled in U.S. conditions. As well-connected Wobbly and future U.S. Trotskyist movement founder James P. Cannon said, quote, the IWW struck a spark in the heart of youth as no other movement in this country. By the accumulated weight of its unceasing propaganda and by its heroic actions, they permeated a generation of radicals with their program for revolution. It was for these reasons that Cannon considered the IWW to be what he called the Great Anticipation. So for him, it wasn't the Socialist Party. It was the IWW that anticipated the possibility of a mass revolutionary party inside the United States. Yet, while the IWW succeeded in building an organization of revolutionaries, it failed to bring lasting unionization to industrial workers. Part of this stemmed from their refusal, before 1916, to sign contracts, which they viewed as peace treaties with the capitalists. The most famous strikes, Lawrence, Schenectady, Paterson, New Jersey, were all in East Coast factory towns, but their main membership and activity was among Western, migrant, agricultural, lumber, and other workers. These members weren't part of stable on-the-job unions. Instead, they just carried their red union card with them from job to job. In Lawrence, where they had 16,000 members during the Great Strike, they didn't sign a contract. A year later, the local had 700 members. The bosses took back all the concessions that they gave in the victory in the Great Strike. And the IWW membership only grew significantly during World War I when they reached about 125,000 members after they did start signing contracts. For example, in the Agricultural Workers Organization. And the leaders of that union within the IWW criticized the traditional IWW emphasis on what they said was talking to people about the ideal state in the far distant future, in the dim distant future, was a quote. So as with other syndicalist unions internationally, when the IWW grew, it started to downplay its revolutionary views. And James P. Cannon's opinion was that by trying to combine a revolutionary organization with a union which has to organize all workers, it couldn't do both. It undermined trying to do either one. Or at best, they could only succeed at one at a time and not both. IWW member William Z. Foster argued that the Wobblies' biggest mistake was dual unionism, forming a separate and hostile federation from the much larger pre-existing AFL. During Foster's trip to France in 1910 and 11, the French CGT syndicalists explained to him that the way they had done it was they took over the existing unions from the inside. And when they were inside, they had their own organizations. They called them the Noyau, so that they had militant minority organization inside. And using these, they patiently proved in practice that direct action tactics and class struggle philosophy worked better. Foster compared the 400,000 CGT members to the struggling IWW, which in 1908 reached a low of about 3,700 members. In France, Foster also learned about Britain's Industrial Syndicalist Education League, or ICEL. The ICEL had formed after Tom Mann, who was a supporter of the English branch of the IWW. He visited the CGT in France, and when he returned to England, he was now opposed to dual unionism. So he formed the ICEL as a propaganda group, not a union, to coordinate revolutionary opposition inside the unions. And ICEL never had more than about 2,000 members in its brief life, but it led a mass semi-insurrectionary strike of Liverpool Dockers in 1911, in which the strike committee for the strike began to assume de facto economic and political authority in the town. The ICEL also pushed for craft unions to group together or amalgamate into big united unions or into just closer alliances of those unions, and these unity proposals were popular. And they led to the formation of the Unified National Union of Railwaymen in 1911. This is in England. And to Foster, these were impressive results compared to the overall frustration and decline in the IWW's early years. So before he left back for the States, the head of the CGT, Leon Zhu Ho, told William Z. Foster to quote, thank you, "Tell the IWW to get into the labor movement." So Foster went back and he attended the IWW convention. And he said to the convention, he proposed, quote, "Let's give up the attempt to create a new labor movement. Let's turn ourselves into a propaganda league, get into the organized labor movement, and by building better fighting machines within the old unions than those possessed by our reactionary enemies, revolutionize those unions, even as our French syndicalist workers have so successfully, fellow workers have so successfully done with theirs." At the convention, he won over 5 out of the 31 delegates, including Vancouver leader Jack Johnstone. Then he launched a debate in the IWW newspapers, Industrial Worker and Solidarity. And then, like a typical wobbly, he launched a hobo tour. He just rode boxcars all over the country, didn't have any money. He almost froze to death on one of these rides on a freight train in Colorado and Kansas. And he went to IWW and AFL union halls all over the country with his new gospel, which was at the relative weakness of the U.S. unions, which he pointed out in the Haymarket era had led the world on the policy of IWW dual unionism. He said that this policy took the best fighters out of the AFL and it isolated them from the members and resources of the million-strong federation. And this allowed the conservative leaders of the unions, what were called the labor fakers, to denounce them as splitters. And this was true, he argued, even where IWW members stayed inside the AFL locals as so-called dual card holders. The second card, he said, would still give an excuse to the labor fakers to hammer them for dual unionism, thus allowing them to avoid the real arguments about direct action, solidarity, and capitalism. So in 1912, Foster and the Washington-based anarchist and Haymarket veteran Jay Fox launched the Syndicalist League of North America. The league had branches in 12 cities, and Foster insisted that it have no dues so that it couldn't even have the appearance of being a dual unionist. A dual union. Rather, he described it as a propaganda society for boring within the existing unions. And while it was tiny, loose, and short-lived, it dissolved by 1915. The Syndicalist League had promising accomplishments. In Kansas City, they led several important strikes. They organized 10,000 to 15,000 new members into the unions, and they kicked out the corrupt and conservative head of the Labor Council in that city. In St. Louis, they led strikes of waiters, taxi drivers, and phone operators. And Foster claimed that the league practically controlled, as he said, the AFL in Nelson, British Columbia. Foster's fire-breathing anarchism in the Syndicalist League years subsided or perhaps went underground in the next phase of his career, which years later, when he was a central leader of the Communist Party, he described as his sag into right opportunism. And for example, he tacitly supported U.S. entry into World War I in 1917, believing that war production and war labor shortages meant massive leverage for unions to finally organize the mass production heart of the U.S. economy. But based in Chicago and working with a few dozen Syndicalist League veterans, including Fox, Johnstone, Lucy Parsons, Sam Hammersmark, and Joe Manley, all of whom later joined him in the Communist Party, Foster offered further proof of the potential for radicals to use the boring from within method to transform the AFL. as a member of the Railway Carmen's Union. He proposed to the Chicago Federation of Labor to bring together all the unions connected to the stockyards industry, the meatpacking industry, into what he called the Stockyards Labor Council. So that happened, and Foster chaired the council, which sort of mirrored the British ICEL's successful amalgamation schemes. And they launched a massive organizing drive that brought in over 60,000 members. Foster aggressively sought to organize the 20% of workers who were black, prioritizing anti-discrimination complaints. He hired black organizers, he reached out to black churches, and he created factory shop steward leaderships in which black workers sometimes led even when there were white workers that they were leading. Broader class support was built through ethnic immigrant organizations, especially among Polish workers. So high on these successes, Foster then proposed a similar organizing plan on a national scale to the AFL for the steel industry. And he became the secretary treasurer of the National Committee for Organizing Iron and Steel Workers, which pulled together 24 AFL unions and workers in states from Pennsylvania to Colorado. The organizing drive faced local bans on Foster or his organizers even entering the steel towns. So he pulled a page out of his IWW playbook and said, let's do free speech campaigns in these towns. By the way, they won't let us come in and talk. They did the free speech campaigns and they were mass and they won, and they were what allowed the organizing to move forward. Foster pushed back against labor faker attempts to delay the strike by organizing a national conference of rank and file steelworkers to focus their demands for action. And at least 250,000 steelworkers struck together in 1919. That was the largest national strike to date. Now, both the stockyards and steel campaigns ended in total defeat, confronted by police and vigilante violence, post-war unemployment and anti-red hysteria, sabotage and underfunding from the AFL head Samuel Gompers and other conservative labor fakers, and ultimately the successful efforts of the employers to stoke racial hatred among the workers. But they were the first breakthroughs to mass industrial unionization in the United States. They brought syndicalist direct action, anti-racism, and to some degree mass democracy right into the AFL, where they could be implemented on a scale that the IWW never approached. So Foster's quasi-syndicalism or post-syndicalism did much to pave the way for labor's 1930s triumphs. But Foster's abandonment of building a formal militant minority organization, even one as loose as the Syndicalist League, left him isolated and unemployed after the defeat of the Great Strike, which Gompers publicly blamed him for. Meanwhile, the first nationwide successful seizure of power by workers in the Russian Revolution showed that syndicalists had been right in the sense that they had the belief that strike action and worker self-organization would provide the force for revolution and the grassroots democratic structure for workers' rule, though it actually took the form of the all-embracing workers' councils or Soviets, not the trade unions as proposed in the Chicago idea. But Russia also showed that a new kind of socialist political party composed of IWW-like collectives of activist workers, not middle-class electoral talking heads, as the syndicalists of the time had always seen the socialist parties as being, that this new type of party was necessary to win the workers' councils and the unions over to revolution and to organize political action, including insurrection. And because of the inspiration of this lesson, there was a kind of IWW reunion that happened as Foster and his coterie joined the new Russian Revolution-inspired Communist Party alongside about 2,000 members of the IWW, including many of its top leaders like Big Bill, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, and Cannon. And this was part of an international convergence and synthesis of Marxism and syndicalism that the Communist International, with partial success, sought to forge. In fact, syndicalists brought unique and sophisticated analysis of union work that has been essential to the tradition of socialism from below ever since into the Communist International. British Unionist J.T. Murphy, veteran of the shop stewards movements which created workers' councils in Scotland during the war, he argued that the experience of revolutionary unionism, the core concept of syndicalism, had turned out to just be impossible. And this was not just because the union's job is to organize all workers regardless of political views, as Cannon's critique of the IW had stressed. Fundamentally, Murphy argued that it was because the unions are structured and finally evolved as bargaining machines to negotiate with the capitalists, accepting their authority. The union machine and the ideology of the personnel staffing that machine, the union bureaucracy, of necessity, adapt themselves to this purpose. So the powerful Scottish strike movement that Murphy helped lead was led by non-officials. It was led by rank and file working union shop stewards organized independently of the bureaucrats. They organized for struggle from below against the bosses always and against the bureaucracy when necessary, which was often. Their focus was building rank and file power from below, not taking over or winning leadership per se. They thought sometimes you can take over leadership, sometimes it's not helpful, but always if you take over union leadership, there's going to be powerful conservatizing pulls, no matter who you are or what your politics are. Murphy and other ex-syndicalists in the Communist International then married this rank-and-file approach to revolutionary union work with the party-building project, and the party provided a more robust form of militant minority organization for the union rank and file. Because it wasn't limited to just the shop stewards, or like in the Syndicalist League, you had to be a unionist to be a part of it. Instead, it was connected to the all-sided and specialized political work of the Revolutionary Party. The goal of party organization inside the unions was not to make the unions auxiliaries of the parties, which is how they tried to do it in the Second International. Instead, following Murphy, it was to organize rank and file independent fighting capacity. Along these lines, in the United States, Foster led the early communist union work in the Trade Union Educational League, which coordinated independent rank-and-file groups in the United Mine Workers, the textile workers, and several others, once again with promising results, and once again it didn't have time to fully flower. Stalinism took over Russia, corrupted the ideas, that meant that the Communist Party's ideas were corrupted in each country. So Stalinism lost and made a mockery of the highly sophisticated rank-and-file strategy. Foster built his entire career and reputation on the idea of boring from within the unions, in opposition to dual unionism. But in an incredible irony, he came to lead the Communist Party USA just when it embraced, on Stalin's orders, a dual unionist approach just as sectarian and far more fruitless than the IWW had been in its day. In 1928, CP members left the AFL unions to form locals of the dual unionist and ironically named Trade Union Unity League. Yet another dual unionist formation. But the early Communist International rank and file strategy survived in the tiny Trotskyist movement. In 1934, Minneapolis Teamsters, that strike showed that politically organized revolutionaries inside a conservative union could transform it into a democratic organ of a successful citywide general strike. In the 40s, the even smaller Trotskyist group called the Workers' Party organized dynamic rank-and-file caucuses in the UAW and other unions. In the 1970s, the International Socialists, descendants of the Workers' Party, did a study group on Foster's trade union, the TUEL, the Trade Union Education League, before they launched rank and file groups in the 1970s strike wave in mining, communications, longshore, and of course the Teamsters, which as a result of that, today maintains the strongest union rank and file opposition caucus in the US, Teamsters for a Democratic Union. In 2010, ISO members helped win election for the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, which won elections to the top offices of the Chicago Teachers Union and led the 2012 strike on social justice, mass democratic, and class struggle principles. To conclude, today the 20th century decline of working class organization and politics is giving way to a fitful rebirth of a working class international left. We're getting back on the right track to self-emancipation. Revolutionaries are struggling toward new successes in unions in Greece, South Africa, Mexico, Tunisia, Egypt, Venezuela, and elsewhere. In this country, smaller scale efforts have opened up. Revolutionaries are active in and around unions, including IWW syndicalists who have organized LA port truckers, Starbucks baristas, and as dual card holders among graduate student unionists in San Diego at the UC. Smaller fish in bigger oceans are those influenced to different degrees by the communist syndicalist synthesis of the 20s, who have facilitated connections between AFL-CIO unions and Occupy, kept alive a labor left through Labor Notes and Teamsters for a Democratic Union, and built surging opposition teacher movements inside their unions in Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, and New York City. IWW Direct Action, Mass Democracy, and Anti-Racism fosters boring from within using a militant minority, and J.T. Murphy's rank and file focus, married to a party building project, are starting points for those of us working in this tradition. But virtually all revolutionaries in unions today look to aspects of the history presented here. Therefore, I propose a discussion here where speakers freely talk about history or about current work, but where discussions of history tie to questions before us today, and where discussions of current work use this history to interpret today's work.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.